Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to Calf Chats. I am joined today by
Major Dustin Morgan
and
Jack Brocker,
who is our intern this summer. And Jack is going to help us out with this podcast, which is United States versus Brinkman Coronel. It's a two-issue case, really, where we're talking about the recusal of a judge and a search and seizure issue. So Jack, go ahead and take it away with the facts, and then we'll start talking about the certified issues.
So Brinkman was decided by a military judge alone. The accused was convicted of attempted sexual assault of a child who has attained the age of 12 years, attempted sexual abuse of a child, absence from place of duty, communication of indecent language, two specifications of wrongful possession of child pornography, and three specifications of wrongful distribution of child pornography in violation of Articles 80, 86, and 134. The military judge sentenced the accused to be dismissed from the service and to be confined for 9 years and 10 days. On appeal, U.S. Army Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed the conviction in a divided opinion. The misconduct involves the accused engaging in sexually explicit communications and attempting to meet someone he believed to be a 14-year-old boy, as well as possessing and distributing child pornography later uncovered through a forensic search of his phone. The legal issues focus on whether the accused's husband had the authority to consent to the phone search and whether the military judge should have recused himself due to potential conflicts of interest. While the accused was stationed in Hawaii, his husband relocated to Michigan, pending the accused's administrative separation from the Army for cocaine use. During this time apart, the accused contacted an undercover enforcement agent who was posing as a 14-year-old boy named Skyler on a dating application. When Skyler informed the accused he was 14, he asked if the accused was upset. The accused replied, quote, "I'm not, and I'd like to kiss you," end quote. The accused proceeded to block Skyler's profile, but later decided to reestablish contact. After unblocking the profile, the accused told Skyler that Skyler was not supposed to be on the application. However, the conversation turned sexual, and the accused arranged to meet Skyler the next day. Upon arriving at the agreed-upon location, the accused was apprehended by the Army Criminal Investigation Division. A military magistrate denied CID's verbal request to search the accused's phone. However, the commander of Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickman authorized a search of the seized phone. The accused was released by CID into the custody of their company commander, who placed conditions on his liberty, such as checking in with the company commander on a regular basis. During this time, the accused sent 4 text messages to his husband, telling him to immediately come to Hawaii, find the accused's phone, and look for videos in a specific folder on the phone. Hours later, and before the husband saw the messages, the accused sent a message, quote, "Please disregard the previous messages. I had a crisis. I'm better now." His husband called him, and the accused allayed his concerns, and the husband did not make the trip to Hawaii or notify the authorities. The following morning, the accused failed to appear at either staff duty or morning formation. The company commander went to the accused's phone, was unable to reach him, feared for his safety, and contacted his husband, who gave the company commander permission to enter the home. The husband gave the company commander broad authority to do what they had to do to find the accused. An initial search of the house failed to uncover the accused's whereabouts. Later the same day, the husband informed CID agents about the vacuum phone. With assistance from the husband, the agents uncovered the phone in the accused's vacuum, which a manual search revealed goodbye messages left by the accused to his loved ones. The husband was under the impression that this was his everyday phone. The agent at the scene did not search beyond the quick manual search so as to avoid tampering any data.
So, Jack, I'm going to interrupt you for just a second. So when you say manual search, what we're talking about is the CID agent going through and looking at the phone, like just actually manipulating the phone itself, as opposed to using some kind of tool like Cellebrite or something like that to pull the data off and manipulate the data. So when we're talking about a manual search, CID typically doesn't like to do that because when you manipulate the phone, when you do that kind of manual search, it can affect the data that's on the phone. So typically the CID does that as like a means of last resort. So go ahead, sorry.
An initial search of the house failed to uncover the accused's whereabouts. Later the same day, the husband informed CID agents about the vacuum phone. While examining the phone, a CID digital forensic examiner found images and videos of suspected child pornography. After a military magistrate's search authorization, additional searches of the phone revealed the accused distributed videos containing child pornography and chatted with others about his interest in young boys. At trial, the defense moved to suppress the evidence found on the vacuum phone and all derivative evidence. The military judge denied the motion, reasoning the husband had common authority over the vacuum phone, capable of giving consent to access the entire phone, gave broad consent to CID concerning the house and many items in it. The accused's behavior created a sense of emergency, and the accused did not revoke consent when he told the husband to disregard the message about his phone. The defense also sought to disqualify the military judge under RCM 902, arguing that the military judge's impartiality may be reasonably questioned based off both his background as a special victims prosecutor during a time frame in which some of the misconduct occurred, and the judge's relationship and work with both trial counsel in previous investigations involving sexual assault, child abuse, and domestic violence as a special victims prosecutor. The military judge denied the accused's challenge, and the lower court on appeal found the military judge did not abuse their discretion due to the judge's forthcoming responses demonstrating that he had no prior knowledge of or involvement in the accused's case.
Thank you, Jack. So the granted issues in this case are twofold, like I said, and the first one was whether the lower court erred in finding that the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he failed to recuse himself from the appellant's court-martial for the appearance of bias. And then the second granted issue was whether the military judge abused his discretion when he denied the motion to suppress the evidence discovered from the search of appellant's vacuum phone and all of the derivative evidence. So, Major Morgan, let's talk about the first issue first.
Yeah, so this really derives from a simple premise. So the judge in this case had previously been assigned as a special victims prosecutor in the jurisdiction where this case was happening. So for those of you unfamiliar with the Army system in particular, the special victim prosecutor program was really the Army's precursor to the special trial counsel program. So they were trained prosecutors that sat in a jurisdiction that advised on and helped people prosecute cases that involved special victims. And in that role, they're talking to the trial counsel, the line prosecutors, and they're advising and collaborating with CID on a pretty extensive basis. And here, this arose because the whole investigation, the reason that the accused was brought to trial was from this undercover operation called Operation Kiki Shield, which was an operation that happened on the island of Hawaii that was done interagency, and it was pretty massive. I remember in appellate division when I was there, we saw 5 or 6 of the cases from Operation Kiki Shield. So the judge was the special victims prosecutor during a vast majority of Operation Kiki Shield. So the defense had a reasonable question like, hey, how much do you know about this? Like, is there a question as to your partiality? Can you sit in this case in an impartial manner? So they challenged him under our 902. So because the judge made that ruling, like Jack said, it was reviewed for an abuse of discretion. And the case law says one thing. It's not just whether or not you are in fact biased, which isn't the question here. The CAF was pretty quick to say there's no evidence of actual bias here and he wasn't challenged for actual bias, but it's the perception, because even the perception of bias on the part of a military judge can lead to disqualification. And the case law, which goes back over a decade now, says that any conduct that would lead a reasonable person, knowing all the circumstances, to the conclusion that the judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned should be disqualified from sitting in the case. And here they said, no problem. And they talk about there's no indication the judge played any role in the investigation. There's no indication he knew any facts going into the case about this particular accused, this particular case. And they said even the fact that he was in a supervisory role didn't disqualify him. Like the fact that he may have been talking to the trial counsel, may have been advising them on other cases similar to this, Like, the fact that they may have known about it is not imputed up towards him. And they make a pretty broad statement at the end of the opinion for this part, at least. Being like, with the small nature of the military justice program and how we're moving around and taking new jobs all the time, if that were the standard, no one could be a military judge ever, because you're not just put into the JAG Corps and automatically made a judge. Like, if our decisions and what we do is imputed up through us, no one could ever be impartial if that were the standard. So good to go at the end of the day.
We'll talk takeaways at the end, but I think that this is the kind of issue. We talked a little bit with Harbirth, which is going to come out shortly, but this, I think, too, requires a lot of buildup of the facts. And that probably requires a lot of buildup on the facts on both the part of the counsel and the military judge, right?
Yeah, and I think counsel can't be afraid to ask questions, because the judge will say, I'm not aware of any manner that might disqualify me in this court-martial. The counsel from each side request to question me. Like, if you have an issue, like, that's your time to speak up. Like, I know, especially as a junior practitioner, it may be hard to, what could be perceived as going at the judge, but, like, as a defense counsel in particular, your client has a right to a fair trial, so... like, develop the record there. The judges typically will do a really good job of putting it on the record beforehand if they think there's even a hint of bias there, but you have to be ready to answer that call and make them answer questions.
Yeah, and I think, too, what I would recommend to my litigators is that this certainly shouldn't be something you're thinking about as you are, as the judge says, I'm not aware of any manner that might disqualify me. Like, these should be questions that you have thought out, have probably written out, because you're going to know that this issue is an issue before you walk in there.
Yeah, it's not going to be a surprise. Like, I don't see that coming up, like, often at all.
Okay, so issue two is a Fourth Amendment issue. And essentially, it boils down to whether or not the appellant's husband had the apparent authority to grant consent for CID agents to get access to the phone that was in the vacuum. First of all, we have to think about whether or not the appellant's husband actually had the authority as a third party to consent to the search of the house. And remember, when Jack talked to you about the facts, that the appellant's husband was not located in Hawaii. The appellant's husband had moved out because the accused was actually pending separation for, I think, cocaine use.
Yeah, cocaine use.
Yeah, so the appellant's husband had moved out, had moved back to Michigan to prepare their life, and was not actually living in the house. However, that doesn't matter. When we look at whether or not someone has the authority over the property to grant consent, and remember, consent is sort of the easy way to get around the Fourth Amendment requirements. This is language from this particular case. The authority which justifies third-party consent does not rest upon the law of property, rather on mutual use of the property by persons generally having joint access or control for most purposes. And so for this purpose, CAF held that the appellant's husband did have the authority to consent. Now, what's interesting is one of the undercurrents when they're talking about this particular issue is, again, CAF and Judge Sparks, in writing this opinion in particular, talks about the unique nature of cell phones. Cell phones occupy a unique place in contemporary society, but that they have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their cell phones. But that unique aspect of cell phones doesn't overcome the third-party authority that appellant's husband had to grant access to the phone. Now, even if he didn't have actual authority, he could have apparent authority. And really, it's just whether or not it appeared to the law enforcement officers that this person had the authority to grant access. And it's kind of a reasonableness analysis, as with everything with the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. It's really a totality of the circumstances and a reasonableness analysis. And CAF held, in this particular context, that there is no doubt that DBC, the appellant's husband, common authority over his and appellant's home, gave him at least apparent authority to consent to the search. It was really a pretty straightforward analysis. And the other part of it was that not only did appellant's husband have apparent authority to grant access to the phone, the follow-on question, an inherent part of the question, was whether or not CID conducted a reasonable search when they searched for the phone. So I interrupted Jack when you're talking about the facts, because CID had gone in and manually manipulated the phone, because the reason that they were going in to search the phone was to find clues as to the appellant's whereabouts. It was not to search for evidence of a crime. It was ostensibly to search for information about where he'd gone, if he was safe, if something had happened to him. And so CID had gone in, and with an agent was manually manipulating the phone in an effort to find that information. And again, given that the fact that they were manually manipulating the phone, to me, indicates why they were searching, yeah. Right? Like, they were not looking for evidence. They were looking for clues as to where he was. And the CAF, when discussing this particular issue, cites to Shields. And remember, Shields is that case where the court sort of analyzed the way in which CID searched a phone. And CAF has been very, very clear that they're not going to dictate how a phone should be searched and where they should, where CID agents should search for things, because phones are so ethereal, right? There's so much information in so many different places that it's really hard for courts to say, this is how you should search it, because it's just, it's too hard. And so even though the CID agent, I think, was looking at images and those kinds of things, CAF held that that was a reasonable search.
How do you think this squares with Black? I have a hard time squaring this case with Black. When I first read it, I know you and I have talked about how we read the facts and we predict how things are going to come out. So we've never done a CAF Chaffs episode on Black. Maybe we have. Maybe it was before our time. But that common authority case, the accused gave his phone to one of his friends, wrote his PIN code down, and was like, hey, use this for watching videos, sending text messages, stuff like that. So a little bit more limited grant. Of scope. Do you think that's what it is?
Yeah, so I think that's certainly what it is. And so part of the issue too was that, so appellant had called his husband and said, get rid of the phone. He said to get rid of some stuff on the phone in the vacuum, and said, you know, to do that. And then he had called back and said, no, I'm fine. I was in a crisis. Don't worry about it. Disregard. And so I can see where Black and this case feel like they contradict, but I think that there was a lot, the relationship was significantly different in that with Black, it was his buddy that was on staff duty, and his buddy didn't have a phone. And so Black was like, yeah, bud, you can use my phone for X, Y, and Z purposes. Whereas this is kind of a whole different relationship. It's a marital relationship. They shared the home. Now, one of the things that I really got caught up on is the fact that the husband didn't live in the home anymore. And so there weren't really any facts in this opinion. I don't remember if it was developed in the Army Court opinion where, you know, had the husband's stuff been moved out, right? Like, did he still have this common authority? But at the end of the day, really, the question was, did it appear that he had authority? And again, for me, it was the relationship, the fact that he knew where the phone was, the fact that it was a hidden phone, he knew where it was. There was a lot of facts here that made it a lot broader for me than Black.
Yeah, and I think it drives home your point that these are fact-intensive inquiries, because I agree with you, it's probably different. But just initially, upon my first reading of this case when it came out, what, 2-3 weeks ago now, I went into it with the lens of Black on and was not surprised, but like interested to see that it came out differently.
Yeah, and I don't know, too, if it had a little bit different perspective, a little bit different angle because of what they were looking for.
Yep.
So in Black,
they were
looking for information. They were looking for evidence. They were looking for contraband. They were looking for evidence of a crime. Here, they were looking for information as to where he had gone. They don't talk about exigency in this case, but it was almost like there's an exigency element of it. And so, you know, that's what they were looking for as opposed to contraband. But I got more caught up on the fact that the husband wasn't in the house anymore. And from my recollection of the facts, and Jack, correct me if I'm wrong, my recollection of the facts are that the husband was on the phone with CID. Did he possess, you know, especially if he'd moved out? I don't know. That's really what got me. But the Black question's an interesting one.
So, I mean, this area continues just to be a quagmire that we're going to have to kind of piecemeal as we go through, I think.
Yeah. And again, it's all going to be for defense counsel. Now, remember, defense counsel files the motion, and who has the burden?
The defense. Yep. Well, the government wants it's a prove it card, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
They have the burden to file the motion.
Right,
but
right,
like once they do, I've always viewed it as a prove it card of the government.
Yes, that's For both sides, the facts are going to be incredibly important, but I think in particular for the defense, because you're going to have to respond and you're going to have all your ducks in a row before you file this motion. And so again, the takeaway I think for the field is that you need to absolutely have all of the details that you can, because you've got one of the most important sources of evidence, which is your client when you're the defense. And for the government, can't just walk in and be like, say that everything's okay and like sort of put this gloss over everything. Like, you've got to get down in the weeds and be very detailed, have a timeline, understand who said what to whom, which means you're going to have to talk to the CID agent. You're going to have to talk to the husband. You're going to have to like do a lot of digging for this particular motion.
Yeah, and I think being prepared as government counsel, because all too often you're just used walking into the courtroom and being like, well, this is the defense's burden. Like, well, here are the initial burden of persuasions on the defense to show something happened. Like, this is your burden of proof as the government to be like, you know, nothing wrong happened here.
Yep.
So call witnesses. Like, you can't just sit back and be like, ah, it's the defense's motion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's the defense's problem. The defense has the burden. No.
So for the judge disqualification, we've said this before, like, you can't just sit back and be intimidated by the judge if you think there's a true issue. Defense counsel did a good job here of getting facts out during voir dire. And I think that's what you'd have to do here. Now, it ended up not being an issue ultimately. But like Major Wendt said, you're going to know when there's an issue coming up. So just be prepared to ask questions and develop the record on it.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be awkward, right? You don't have to, like, this is true of any cross-examination or any sort of pseudo-adversarial witness. You don't have to come at them in an adversarial way. You can ask these questions respectfully. And I think any military judge worth their salt is not going to be offended that you're asking these questions. And any judge who is offended, I think there's a bigger problem there.
Yeah, you probably don't want to fight the judge. That's just good life advice, but...
I mean, I don't know that I totally subscribe to that. But, I mean, listen, at the end of the day, it's the judge's decision, and you got to appear in front of that judge. So probably don't fight the judge is good advice. We've already talked about sort of developing the record and developing the facts and how detailed these cases are. So that's the only other piece of advice that I have for the field. But before we sign off, Jack, let's hear a little bit about you. Where are you from? Where are you going to law school? And why are you interested in joining the JAG Corps?
Thank you, Major Wentz. So I'm originally from Newton, Massachusetts, which is just outside Boston. I graduated from Boston College in 2022, and I'm currently at American University, Washington College of Law in DC. I was motivated to join the JAG Corps. I've always been interested in some kind of military service. My family has a history of military service. And when I got to Boston College, I lived with a lot of ROTC students. And the combination of seeing their service post-grad and also after graduating BC, I had the chance to serve as special assistant to Congressman Seth Moulton from Massachusetts, who's a Marine Corps veteran. And the combination of seeing and hearing and learning about his story of service and my friend's stories of service motivated me to pursue my passion for law and service to country, which is embodied in the JAG Corps.
That's awesome. Well, I think you're going to have a great summer at TJAGLIX. This is unfortunately my last CAF Chats.
Thank you from all of us at the school. I'm sure the listeners definitely benefited from you and all your insights. And I know you tried really hard not to give your opinions ever, and they appreciate the unedited, unfiltered takes that you gave a lot of the times. We'll be sad to see you go. I'm sure you'll have a great time as TDS counsel leading the TDS office down at Fort Cavazos.
Thank you all so much. I have really enjoyed it, and I will see you all out in the field.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's Corps, the Department of the Army, or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.